At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm the culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very, very pleased to be joined today by Ken Aletta, who is he's been contributing to The New Yorker since 1977 and launched The Annals of Communication, his series of stories on the way media and culture and news and politics all intersect in 1992. He's the author of 13 books and of some of my all-time favorite pieces in one of my all-time favorite magazines, the 2014 profile of Theranos's Elizabeth Holmes, 2006 piece on Anthony Pelicano scandal and the effects that it had on the powerhouse LA Hollywood lawyer Bertram Fields, and of course his 2002 profile of Harvey Weinstein. And he is on the show today to talk about his new book about Harvey Weinstein, Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. Very glad to have him on. Mr. Aletta, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
So I want to expand on the subhead of your book very briefly here, because there's an interesting passage that kind of really gets to the theme, right? Here it is. Quote, if you were an actor, director, or screenwriter with Oscar dreams, Harvey was an especially important gatekeeper. His secrets also stayed secret because in the movie business, abnormal male sexual aggression was thought to be common, fit for private whispers, but not public shame. This was Hollywood's culture of silence, end quote. But that's kind of only half the story, really, right? How did Hollywood's desire to keep its secrets dovetail with the trade and gossip press's desire to maintain access?
Well, clearly, one of the things that, and I quote some reporters, gossip columnists, is saying that they kept quiet about certain things. They saw drug use, for instance, some of the Miramax screening parties afterwards, and they kept silent because that was their ticket to come back to more screenings and get more invitations. Harvey had enormous power, and one of the things my book tries to do is explore his power and how he used and both abused it as well. And the culture in Hollywood, not unlike the culture in the Republican Party today with Donald Trump telling lies and just Republicans acquiescing and because they're afraid he's going to run candidates against them in primaries, or the blue shield in the police departments, which protect misbehaving cops. You don't want to feel like a rat, so you conform and keep your mouth shut. And Republicans keeping their mouth shut. And people in Hollywood who knew or should have known that Harvey was abusing women kept their mouth shut and allowed him for more than four decades to continually abuse women.
Let's talk about Harvey Weinstein's rise, because I do think it's an interesting story here. I mean, here is a guy who is he's seen as a genuine tastemaker, and I think rightly seen as a genuine tastemaker, arguably, you know, did as much to change the way and the sort of movies that were made since Robert Evans, you know, the producer of The Godfather, or a beloved director like Steven Spielberg. How did his power as a tastemaker both ingratiate him into Hollywood and protect him from some of these criticisms?
Well, one of the things, I mean, as you allude to, I mean, he made amazing and distributed amazing movies. Pulp Fiction, My Left Foot, Crying Game, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. One can go on and on. And you can't erase that legacy of movies that he had a hand in, and his talent. And my book tries to show his talent as well as his monstrosity. But if you're an actor or director, and you have ambitions to really be associated with great movies and maybe win Academy Awards, someone who's making those kind of movies with someone you want to be associated with, as opposed to people who are doing these sequel movies, you know, Killer Bees and stuff like that. And so Harvey was a magnet for people who thought they were talented and had a shot at really, you know, a great career.
Yeah. And there's a, there's kind of a flip side to this coin, right? James Ivory, you know, of the famed Merchant Ivory production team, told David Carr back in 1994 or whatever, you know, he's both a genius, quote, he's both a genius and an asshole. And unfortunately, those things seem to go together. End quote. I mean, that is a common Hollywood thing, right? You hear about the monstrous, mean director, producer who is, you know, just kind of a jerk to everyone, but it's worth it because they make great movies.
No question. And, you know, but one of the things I try to do in the book is to look at the history of what's called the casting couch, which was Harvey's defense for himself. Mm-hmm. He said these were consensual affairs I was having with these women. It was traditional casting couch stuff that always took place in Hollywood over the many, many decades. But there's a difference between casting couch and rape. Harvey was raping women. Mm-hmm. That's a criminal offense. Casting couches may not be always a criminal offense. But if you read the descriptions that I provide in the book and before me much more impactfully, you know, than two New York Times reporters and Rona Farrow in The New Yorker, he was holding women down. He was violently accosting them. And that was a criminal offense. One of the reasons he was convicted and sentenced to 23 years in prison in New York State.
Yeah. We'll get to the New Yorker story in a minute because there's an interesting connection you have to that. Before we do that, though, I want to talk a little bit about the way that Weinstein was able to kind of connect politics and culture. In your book, you highlight the way he had promoted My Left Foot, right, by having Daniel Day-Lewis appear before Congress. And from there, he became a genuine power broker in the Democratic Party, right? He's doing fundraisers for Hillary Clinton. One of President Obama's daughters has an internship at the Weinstein Company. I don't want to say this is funny, but there is a darkly humorous moment in the in his downfall where he says, you know, I've learned my lesson and I'm going to turn my anger on the NRA and Wayne LaPierre. I mean, to what extent was he connected by his political connections as all of this was going on, as people were, you know, whispering but not really talking about what happened?
Harvey had, you could argue he was deluded, but he believed he was, as he once proudly proclaimed, I'm the effing sheriff of this effing town. And he thought he had enormous power. And he can get the Clintons to come through the screenings. He could hire Obama's daughter. He stayed at, you know, he was at Camp David. I mean, he was a major power broker in Democratic politics. By the way, he was a big supporter of Governor Pataki, Republican governor of New York State, raised a lot of money for him as well. Michael Bloomberg, I mean, as mayor of New York. So Harvey thought of himself as a potentate, not just in the movie business, but not just in politics, but in our culture. People gravitated. They wanted to be in his presence. He was Harvey. They knew him by his first name. And I think that went to his head. And he thought he can get away with everything. And for many, many years, he did.
The idea of there's a very, again, kind of amusing story in your book where he's you know, saying that he needs to have sit downs with prime ministers and there's, you know, extending beyond the borders of America. It is an almost amazing level of self-delusion. I as somebody who spends a lot of time around Hollywood people and who like knows lots of folks like this, even then, it is still kind of like, wow, I can't believe he thought he could do all this.
Well, you know, I tell a story in the book where he went to a wedding in Rome, of a former associate, and it was very, very hot and he was really uncomfortable. And he says to his assistant, get the Pope on the line. I want to see if I can air condition this church. Well, get the thought that you could get the Pope on the line, I mean, it's quite unbelievable that he would have that level of self-delusion. And, yeah. But that's what he thought he was a maca. He thought he was a really big deal.
Yeah. And one of the ways, again, this kind of intertwining of politics and culture and all that, you know, there is you have a series of just numbers in your book about the advances he gave to journalists, politicians, you know, lawyers to essentially buy them off, right? I mean, how is he using the Miramax book label to increase his power and his control over the people in his world?
He started Miramax Books, and he gave a number of book contracts out, Mika and Joe and Tim Russert, and who was a bestseller for him, by the way. I mean, some of them really turned out well. But he was giving screenplay contracts to gossip columnists, and he used his power as a studio head to give contracts for films to journalists, and as well as inviting them to screenings and parties, et cetera, and giving them exclusive interviews. But in addition to that, he created a publishing, Miramax Books, this publishing company, and he was giving out book contracts, some of them very lucrative contracts, to book. He gave $3 million to Rudy Giuliani, which turned into zero. You know, David Boies got $1 million, became his longtime attorney. So he was parceling out gifts. Now, Miramax Books actually had some success, but they also had a number of failures. But Harvey didn't see it as a failure. He was using it to buy influence.
And this, the Miramax Books and the magazine that he tried to start brings him into conflict with Disney, which he, you know, Disney has purchased Miramax at this point, and he is now kind of using Disney money to fund his empire building, his own personal empire building. What was the story there, and how did Disney feel? How did Disney, and in the form of Bob Iger and Michael Eisner, feel about Harvey Weinstein?
They were enraged. They had a contract with him. They acquired Miramax in 1993, but he couldn't spend more than $30 million on a movie. And within a number of years, he was exceeding that limitation, and just getting away with it, and would drive them nuts. In terms of Talk Magazine, Tina Brown, who he recruited to edit from The New Yorker, to edit Talk Magazine, calls up Michael Eisner, who she knew, and said, "Michael, I'm so glad we want to be working together." And Eisner said, "Working together? How?" And he said, "Well, I'm editing your new magazine." And Eisner knew nothing about it. Harvey didn't tell him. And Eisner was doubly upset because Disney had sold magazines. They didn't believe it was a future growth industry. So suddenly, he calls up Harvey, and he reads the Riot Act to Harvey, and he's very upset. He hangs up. No decision was made at that point. He's in Aspen, and he has dinner with Leonard Lauder, a Lauder company. And he tells Lauder the story, and Lauder tells him, and I recount this in the book, Lauder tells him, "You can't take on Harvey Weinstein. He's too powerful. You'll be criticized in the press for acting like an obstreperous boss." And Eisner didn't take him on, but wanted to and failed to. And what does that tell you? It tells you, in part, Harvey had power that even Disney, his parent company, was afraid of him.
Yeah, it's something else. It is really, really something else. Now, like as a journalist, the most interesting part of the book to me is your recounting of reporting out the original profile of Weinstein that you wrote back in 2002. I think it's December of 2002. I was shocked to learn in this book that you actually had the names of some of the first women who signed NDAs with non-disclosure agreements with Harvey Weinstein, Rowena Chu and Zelda Perkins. Can you recount for us, the writing of that story, the reporting of that story, but also how you tracked them down and the way you were almost able to get that information into the story, and the difficult call that was made to leave it out at the end of the day?
Well, a producer who I now can identify, she agreed, who was Donna Gigliotti, who later won an Academy Award, and she was one of the producers on Shakespeare in Love. And during the making of that movie, she learned that these two women were that particularly Rowena Chu was abused by Harvey sexually, and that Zelda Perkins, his then London assistant, came to Rowena's aid, and they wanted to bring charges. And initially, Donna helped them, brought them to a lawyer, et cetera. I said, "Donna, will you go public if I can get these women to talk?" And she said, "I might, but you have to get them to talk first." So I tracked Zelda down to Guatemala, where she was raising horses. She had left the movie business And she hung up the phone. She said, I won't talk to you. She wouldn't. And Rowena, she was in Asia somewhere, but I couldn't find her. And so I couldn't reach her as well. So I went back to Donna Gigliotti and she said, I can't go public on this. But I knew the two names. So in my last interview with Harvey Weinstein in 2002, I said, Harvey, tell me what happened at the 1998 Venice Film Festival with Rowena Chu and Zelda Perkins. And he got all agitated. And he said, what are you doing? What are you doing? I said, Harvey, I want to know, did you attempt to rape Rowena Chu at that? Harvey, at that point, stood up. We were in a small conference room, just the two of us. He said, my last interview, I'd done about 12 hours of interviews, but I watched him for months and reported the story for months. He stood up and stood over me and he clenched his fists and his lip was trembling. And he says, if you run that story, it will destroy my marriage to Eve and my three young teenage daughters. Their lives will be, really wrecked in many ways. And I'm sitting down and he's standing up and I'm saying, my God, I can't continue to sit down. He'll take a poke at me. I'm a sitting duck. So I stood up and I faced him. We're roughly the same height. He was about 100 pounds more than me. But as I faced him, as I stood up, suddenly, what did Harvey do? He started to cry. And I don't mean a tear rolling down his cheek. I mean wailing. Oh, it's going to destroy my life. It's terrible. You can't do that. And so I am thinking, is this just a bully who, when confronted, backs down and caves? Is this a guy who was really terrified for the first time that he would be exposed in a story? So what happened then, he didn't know whether we're going to run that story or not. And he thought we might. And David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, said, Ken, I don't know how we can run the story. We don't have any women. It's just conjectural. We don't have any woman who's come out and says, he did this to me or he attempted to do this to me. And if we do that, we're like the National Enquirer. We can't do it. I agreed with them. We couldn't run the story unless we had women on the record. And they wouldn't go on the record. So the story didn't run in 2002 because of that.
There's an interesting part in this story where you write that if you had written the story then, you likely would have said that he raped these women or he raped Rowena. And that would have been wrong. I mean, knowing is.
I learned from interviewing her in more recently for the book that she was not raped.
And I feel like it's a, there's a lot of talk. Everybody talks about media ethics, but I do think this is a very important example of the difficult balancing act you have to do as a reporter. I mean, you don't want to be wrong. You also don't want to miss the story. And it really is. I cannot recommend this book enough for if you are an aspiring journalist or if you're just interested in how journalism works. That whole section is really great and worth reading. The story does eventually come to The New Yorker, though. Ronan Farrow is working at NBC. He's working on a big story about Harvey Weinstein. He has people who will go on the record and some who will, only speak kind of on background or hidden on camera. And NBC kills it. This is the Harvey Weinstein protection machine at work. You talk to him. How did you help bring his blockbuster reporting to The New Yorker?
Well, what happened was I didn't know Ronan Farrow, and he called me in the spring of 2017. This is 8 months before Harvey was exposed in the fall of 2017. He called me, said he's doing a story. He told me what he was reporting on. I only knew him because he was Woody Allen's son, and he had gotten involved in defending his sister, who claimed that Woody Allen, her father, had abused her sexually. I was a little wary because saying, is Ronan Farrow a journalist or is he a zealot? And he convinced me in that conversation by the kind of questions he was asking that he was acting like a careful journalist. So he asked me if he could have access to my papers, which were on file at the New York Public Library. And I gave him access to them on the Harvey Weinstein reporting I did in 2002. He then called me up later in the spring and said, can I interview you I'm doing a piece for NBC on Harvey Weinstein. I said, sure, but yeah, I'm doing a book, so you have to come out and visit me Rich Hampton, to do the interview. He came out and we spent about 4 hours together. And one of the things, at some point I said to him, "So what have you got?" And he said to me, "Well, I've got three women on tape by name saying that Harvey sexually abused them. I've got five women on tape, but shielded, camouflaged, their name's not revealed, their face is not revealed, saying that Harvey sexually abused them. And I've got an audio tape of the Italian model who claimed that Harvey grabbed her breasts in 2015 and the police wired her and he confessed when he met her that in fact he had done that." I said, "My God, you've broken the case. What's the next step?" He said, "Well, I meet with the president of NBC News, Noah Oppenheim, on August 8th. I said, "Great." I didn't hear from him August 8th. On August 9th, I called Ronan. I said, "So how'd you do?" And he sounded depressed. He said, "Well, they killed the story. They killed me. I'm off the case at NBC. They said I could take it elsewhere, but who would want it?" He didn't ask that as a question. It was just a statement he was making. I said, "Ronan, give me your number. I'll call you back." And I took his number down. I called David Remnick, the editor of the New Yorker, and I said, "David, I think this guy, Ronan Farrow, has broken the case that we couldn't break 15 years ago. And he's judicious," was the word I used. I said, "He sounds very judicious to me." He said, "Have him call me on Monday morning." He was closing an issue at that point. So Ronan called him, and then the next is history. I mean, he got the goods over the next 7-8 weeks and published the story. NBC came to me, a very senior executive who I promised not to name, and I don't in the book, but I tell the story of what the executive said. He said, "Ronan didn't have the goods at NBC. He only got the goods after he went to New Yorker." And that's what they claimed to the press at the time about Ronan. So NBC says this, Ronan says that. I said, "There's actually a way to adjudicate who's telling the truth. Let's go to the New Yorker editor who edited the piece and say, what did she learn? What did he actually bring to the New Yorker when he came to them in August of 2017? And she said the following to me, both in verbal form and then in an email. He had five women camouflaged, and he had the audio tape. He had all of that. So NBC is not telling the truth.
Yeah.
Period.
And again, getting back to the web of influence here, I believe Oppenheim had a deal with Weinstein for a script. Was that right?
No, he did. There are five theories as to what would explain why NBC would kill Ronan Farrow's story. I don't know whether any of them are true but this is the conjecture. One is that Noah Oppenheim is a screenwriter. He's had two screenplays. Right? And if he's ambitious to be a screenwriter, Harvey, powerful studio executive, you want to stay on with good graces. Right. That's one theory. Second theory is that his boss, chairman of NBC News, Andy Lack, he and his wife were social friends of Harvey's. That's the second theory. Third theory is Steve Burke, the head of the CEO of NBC, studio head, Universal, does business all the time with Miramax, and studios work together all the time. A fourth theory is that Brian Roberts, the head of the parent company, Comcast, that owns NBC, was a social friend of Harvey's for many years. In fact, when Harvey used to go with his first wife to Martha's Vineyard, Roberts was considered what Harvey called part of his Martha's Vineyard mafia. The fifth theory is that Harvey had information on Matt Lauer, which had not yet come out, about his sexual behavior. And that if you don't run the story on me, I won't spread the story on Matt Lauer. Any of them true? I don't know. It's one of those stories you can't quite penetrate what the reasons are. What you can penetrate is that they killed a really good story, much to their embarrassment.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember when that story broke. I was like, "Oh, they finally have it. This is great." What did you, as you were sitting? I mean, the back third of this book or so is almost a day by day recounting of the trial, which was incredibly useful to me because I had kind of paid attention to the headlines, but had not, you know, actually sat there and read the news reports every day by day as this story was breaking. As you were sitting there in the courtroom, did you get the sense that Harvey was cooked? Did you think he could get out of this? I mean, as a witness and a regular viewer of it, what was your sense in the courtroom?
My sense in the courtroom was that the case that the prosecution had a stronger case than Harvey had in his defense. But the weakness of the prosecution case, and they tried to build around this, was several of these women, despite the fact that Harvey raped them, continued to keep in touch with him. And not only keep in touch with him, sometimes have consensual sex with them after the alleged rapes. And in some cases, have me email exchanged with him. "I miss you, big guy," was one of the statements made, et cetera. And the prosecution had to overcome the sense that the jury might have that these women were ambitious young women who were seeking to further their career and had sex with Harvey willingly in order to further their career. And that was the obstacle that the defense had to overcome. And one of the ways they did it was by constantly harping on this problem, but also by inviting Dr. Barbara Ziv of Temple University to appear as a rape expert. And one of the things she said to the jury, which was quite stunning, is that 40% of rape victims keep in touch with the rapist afterwards. So women keep in touch, and why? And what the prosecution did was try to answer that why question. Women keep in touch because of the denial. "It really didn't happen to me." Or they say, "I'm at fault. Harvey's not at fault. I'm really at fault." Or they say, "I'm afraid. I don't want to go against this guy. He's too powerful." That's among many multiple reasons that women have for why they would keep quiet and not come forward. And I think the prosecution successfully convinced the jury that it was not the overriding issue. The overriding issue was Harvey abused these women. And you would sit there every day, as I did, and watch Harvey. Sometimes as the women were giving this poignant testimony, he would fall asleep. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary. And you say to yourself, is something physically wrong with Harvey, which there was, by the way, or is it that he has so little empathy that he can't even relate to the pain these women are expressing on the witness stand? The jury did, and they found him guilty.
How much of this? I'm curious from your perspective as somebody who reported this out in 2002, who watches the trial in recent years and has now written this book, how much has the culture shifted on understanding of rape victims and how to treat the aggressors in these cases?
Well, I don't know whether we've had a permanent long-term change in terms of behavior on the part of males and rape, you know, sexual harassers, et cetera. There's no question that men are more self-aware of the dangers of misbehavior. And so you see any number of executives you talk to say they will not meet with a woman alone in their office. And if they do, the door is always going to be open because they don't want to be accused of somehow mistreating that person. So is that a long-term change? I don't know. And by the way, if it is a long-term change, there are problems with that. Because one of the values of hiring young people is that they can talk to you and be mentored by you. And the mentoring function with people not only not being in the office because of COVID, but also because men are so self-conscious as to not appear to be harassing or abusing women, that there's less mentoring going on. So that's a negative against the overall positive of the consciousness being raised by men. How permanent that is, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a figure in this whole story who we haven't talked about at all yet, and that person is Bob Weinstein. Okay, you know, Bob Weinstein he's an interesting figure. You track their rise together in the early years in Buffalo and then Manhattan. You know, he is the guy. He personally signs the checks for Chew and Perkins, right? He tells you that his brother claimed he was being blackmailed, and he comes across as relatively contrite in your book, also angry. I mean, he's like, there's this wonderful little anecdote at the end where Harvey asks him to pay, you know, $3.5 million for the rights to Dogma, which a movie I enjoy. I like that movie, but there's no universe in which that movie's worth $3.5 million to, you know, sell on DVD and Blu-ray anymore. What's your sense of Bob Weinstein and what he knew and when he knew it, and how he has actually responded to the all of the revelations and everything else?
Bob was called Bobby. He was 2 years younger than Harvey, and they shared a room in Queens, Flushing, Queens. And he was Harvey's co-head of Miramax. They were equal partners, and Bob brought his talents as well to Miramax. But he was the junior partner, the junior brother, the younger brother. And when Harvey came to him in 1998, and he said, Rowena Chu, I was having an affair with this woman, Rowena Chu, and she threatened to, if I broke up with her, go public and tell my wife and expose my wife and kids to this. Bob, I need your help. Bob then wrote the two non-disclosure checks, totaling almost $500,000 for both women, so $250 each, roughly. When I asked Bob then and subsequently, why did you lay out that money? What did you know? He said, Harvey told me he was being blackmailed. I was helping my brother out. And I said, did you not know he was raping women? And he said, I had no idea he was raping. I knew my brother was a sex addict. And at one point, I got him helped get him into a treatment program after he was exposed in the fall of 2017. Bob became, I found in the reporting for this book, a different person. He was an alcoholic at some point, and he went into treatment and became a true believer in the ethos of therapy, talking it out, confronting your demons, etc. And tried to persuade his brother to do something similar and failed. And in the end, he set up a program for Harvey to go to in Arizona after he was exposed in the fall of 17. And Harvey, instead of entering the program and participating with the other people and cleansing yourself, being contrite, you know, showing, you know, that you really want to learn something. Harvey stayed in a hotel, didn't stay in the cottages where the other residents stayed, and ate at diners, was on his telephone all the time, and basically left the program early. Bob stopped speaking to his brother and hasn't spoken to him since that period of time, and is angry. But he insists that he had no idea that Harvey was abusive, and welcomes the fact that the jury found him guilty of it and believes that they properly found him guilty of it. But he said he didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of these things where it's hard to imagine not knowing, but at the same time, you know, everyone, it's really interesting to look back at some of the jokes that were made by Seth MacFarlane, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, right? You know, the great Peter Piskin book on the Sundance, the rise of Sundance. And there are stories about Harvey Weinstein being crazy and violent there, but you know, at the same time, nobody really thought, I think, that, you know, actual violent rapes were occurring on a fairly regular basis. It's crazy.
In the 2002 profile I wrote of Harvey for the New Yorker, which he hated, by the way, I reported chapter and verse of his violent temper, his abuse of people verbally, and even sometimes physically. I couldn't report the sexual stuff because I couldn't get any woman to confirm that it happened. But I portrayed him as a monster he was, short of the sexual monster he also was. But now it's out, and it's out because of the great reporting that the two Times reporters and Ronan Farrow did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything people should know about Harvey Weinstein, about your book, about you know, the state of the world in general. What do you think folks should know?
Well, among the things I found that I didn't know in when I set out to do a biography of Harvey Weinstein, I didn't know much about his childhood and what happened in his home. Did some things happen in his home that helped shape the person he became. One of the things I learned is that his mother, Miriam, yelled all the time, "Harvey, you're too fat. Harvey, stop doing it, Harvey." So much so, the yelling, that the kids played poker on weekends at different friends' homes. They refused to play at Harvey's home because his mother yelled all the time. But you can see when you look at Harvey, the way he yelled in his office at Miramax and the Weinstein Company after that, clearly a pattern was formed of yelling that the mother had established. Doesn't explain his sexual behavior. You can't attribute that to yelling and the mother. But one of the things you can attribute it to, and I found this out too, I found no evidence that Harvey abused women in junior high school or high school or in the early years, the first 3 years at the University of Buffalo where he attended. After he dropped out of, after his junior year at Buffalo and stayed in Buffalo and became a very successful rock promoter, bringing to Buffalo Sinatra, Rolling Stones, Billy Joel, et cetera, et cetera. He's really making a lot of money, but he had real power. And only when he had power do we see him starting to abuse women. So power, I concluded, became a kind of aphrodisiac for him. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of men who abuse women. The power goes to the head and they think they can get away with it. And when a woman gives them a compliment, they misinterpret that as a come on.
Do you think that the actual world here of music, of touring, you know, I mean, the world of concerts in the 1970s is fairly decadent, as anybody who is, you know, who has read any of the books from that time will tell you or seen any of the movies. I mean, do you think that that might have had played some role in letting him believe that he was owed or deserved these sexual favors?
Well, he did at one point, Harvey did claim that the period of the 70s, open love, open, you know, people, you know, sexual mores being a little different than they had been, that helped persuade him to act a certain way naturally because he thought it was normal. But one of the things you see in looking closely at Harvey's life, he was constantly trying to normalize aberrant behavior. For instance, he would stay in hotel suites when he traveled to another city. He would go out to dinner. His assistant would wait for him in the hotel suite. He'd come home to the hotel suite and shed all his clothes and walk around naked, thinking, and his assistants, like Zelda Perkins, said to me, "Harvey, what are you doing? What, put on your clothes. Why do you walk around?" He said, "Oh, come on. You know, don't be a square. This is normal." And, you know, he normalized sexual behavior as well as aberrant behavior like taking off your clothes. I mean, it's quite a his come on line to women always, I have it throughout the book, "I have a kink in my neck. Can you give me a massage?" You know, it wasn't like "you're gorgeous" or it wasn't the usual Don Juan kind of come on. It was kind of a feeble, "I have a kink in my neck, will you give me a massage?" And then he would say, if they did, "Take off your shirt, I want to give you a massage." You know, it was just kind of,
yeah, I mean, it really, I mean, it's like a freshman in college.
Yeah.
You know, it's, well, thank you very much again for being on the show, Mr. Aletta. The book again, Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. I will link to it in the newsletter with this podcast. Make sure you pick it up. It is a really fascinating look at, I mean, I beyond the trial, beyond that, just the rise of Harvey Weinstein and all that. Really great, must read, must recommend. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm the culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.